The theme for this month in our Soul Matters themes is story. What does it mean to be a community of story? And those are a part of our story and an ongoing story. And that's what I'm going to speak about more today. But Gretchen Haley has said, she's a minister in Fort Collins, Colorado. She said, wouldn't it be handy if we had a set of common stories that we could count on, all of us or most Unitarian Universalists knowing? It would be a great shorthand, similar to how Christians can say, sow your seeds in the good soil, and most understand that as a reference to the Gospel of Matthew and then what that story is about. And so she has a group of stories. She proposes 10 stories for all Unitarian Universalists. And the first story is a creation story. It's Partners by Mark Gelman, found in Does God Have a Big Toe? She says, I could preach on this story for a year. It's so good. Before there was anything, there was God, a few angels, and a huge swirling glob of rocks and water with no place to go. The angels asked God, why don't you clean up this mess? So God collected rocks from the huge swirling glob and put them together in clumps and said, some of these clumps of rocks will be planets, and some will be stars, and some of these rocks will be just rocks. Then God collected water from the huge swirling glob and put it together in pools of water and said, some of these pools of water will be oceans, and some will be clouds, and some of this water will be just water. Then the angels said, they're sort of obsessive, compulsive angels, I think, but they said, well, God, it's neater now. But is it finished? And God answered, nope. So on some of the rocks, God placed growing things and creeping things and things that only God knows what they are. And when God had done all this, the angels asked God, is the world finished now? And God answered, nope. God made a man and a woman from some of the water and stardust and said to them, I'm tired now. Please finish up the world for me. Really, it's almost done. But the man and woman said, we can't finish the world alone. You have the plans and we are too little. You are big enough, God answered them. But I agree to this. If you keep trying to finish the world, I will be your partner. The man and the woman asked, what is a partner? And God answered, a partner is someone you work with on a big thing that neither of you can do alone. If you have a partner, it means that you can never give up because your partner is depending on you. On the days you think I am not doing enough, and on the days I think you are not doing enough, even on those days we are still partners, and we must not stop trying to finish the world. That's the deal. And they all agreed to the deal. Then the angels asked God, is the world finished yet? And God answered, I don't know. Go ask my partners. Creation story. As I said, the theme this month is story, not as falsehood, but as narrative, as that picture of how events, of how life, of how literally our personal plot, as it were, will unfold. At our dinner Friday night, we had a Soul Matters potluck, mostly for families, and we were looking at the Soul Matters material and talking about story. And one of the mothers said that in her preschool, they'd asked the children to ask a question. And one of the children began, well, at my house, and she said, no, that's a story. I want you to ask a question. And then she realized she had to explain story because everybody thought that story was false because their mother would tell them, you're telling me a story. But stories can be false and true at the same time. They can also, they don't have to be just that, a story as a made-up falsehood. We're thinking of stories as, what is the narrative I am telling myself? And once I began to reflect on that, I thought, how simple this is. This really, what am I going to do with this? But once I began to reflect on what is the narrative that I am telling myself, I began to think and see stories. And you know what it did? It took me out of argument. It took me out of, as one friend said, litigation, as it were, in making something right. It took me out of that struggle of the facts, but into the vision and the thinking of the story that I was telling, the narrative from my perspective. We each have our own perspective, but we also construct our own narrative that actually comes from and creates how we perceive and organize, understand and act on reality and the realities of life. When, it's been 4 years now, but my daughter Hannah and I were visiting colleges, and she'd gotten a scholarship to Earlham, which is a small Quaker liberal arts college in Richmond, Indiana, and she'd gotten a full scholarship. Unfortunately, Richmond, Indiana is in the middle of nowhere, and you drive up to Nashville and then over the Cumberland Plateau and then into these farms and woods in Richmond, Indiana, and it was not a very good weekend for Hannah, so Earlham didn't make a great impression, even though Dad was thinking, wow, this is a great place, and you know, and $50,000 a year, let's check that off. But that was the story I was telling, that she was going to like this and she was going to go here. But one of the things that happened in one of the meetings where I was, where Hannah wasn't, they asked the students, what is the story you want to write with your life? Your own story in society. It wasn't about what do you want to do? Okay, there's a difference. What do you want to be? There's a difference. What is the story? What is the narrative that you are creating and putting yourself in? And that just hit me, like I said, man, I want her to go here. She's graduating from Chapel Hill in the spring, and because it's her story. It's her narrative. But the idea, I wanted her to be, and she has been, in a place where you're learning your own story. You're placing yourself in society. You're not just a worker, placing yourself in somebody else's vision of how the world has to work, and you have to make money in order to go on and live your life in a certain way. No. He said, what is your story in all of life, in all of creation, in all of being? What are you going to write? So I got fired up about that. But Gretchen Haley has a sermon called The Danger of a Single Story. Not an open story, but a single limiting story. And she opens with this story. Apparently, the commander of a vessel that was engaged in maneuvers in heavy weather was on the bridge late one night when the watch, she says, I think that's the right term, noted that there was another vessel visible directly ahead of them and some distance away. The commander ordered the appropriate person to contact that vessel and order them to turn so that they would pass to starboard. There was an immediate response saying, we suggest you turn immediately to port. The commander knew the formation of the group of ships with him, even though he couldn't see them because of the weather, and responded with a sharp command for the vessel ahead of him, now closer, to pass to starboard. The vessel responded, we suggest you turn immediately to port. The commander, knowing he couldn't turn to port because there was another ship out there, pulled rank and informed the rogue vessel that this was Commander Jones on the USS Tweedledum on maneuvers, and he expected the ship to get out of his way now. The reply came back, "Sir, this is the North Ipswich Lighthouse. I suggest..." "I suggest you turn immediately to port." The danger of a single story. Reverend Haley goes on to tell another story of her family when they moved to Fort Collins, and her children would come home from school and then pull out stuff from their backpacks, and then they'd talk about it. And one day, her son Joseph was in the midst of this daily routine, and he brought her a green piece of paper for a project his class would be doing for Thanksgiving. "And our class is learning about the pilgrims," it said, "and the story of America, the story of America. To help us explore this story, please talk about these questions with your child." It went on, "At some point your family came to America. Please note below when they arrived and where they came from and what their family name was." And then it had two lines. "My mother's family name was blank. Her family came to America from blank in the year blank. My father's family name is blank. My family came to America from blank in the year blank." After reading, she said she paused and took a deep breath and turned to her curious 6-year-old and said, "Wow, Joseph, I think this assignment is kind of challenging." And she said between her pause and her breath and her measured response, there were a flood of less measured thoughts that raced through her mind. Mother and father, like everyone, has precisely one of each. What's up with this mixing up of parents, generally with biological parents? Was this actually an exercise on ancestry? It doesn't say that. And what does she mean, the story of America? And does she really think the U.S. contains only those whose ancestors traveled here from somewhere else? She said, "I thought about my friends, a 2-mom family that includes a Native American adopted daughter. I wondered, how did Joseph's teacher imagine they would fill out this form?" One limiting story. Unitarian Universalism encourages, I would say more than encourages, but tells the story of many stories brought together and told together and heard together. Unitarianism, with its exalted view of human possibilities, our lives, our stories can be lived out with the guidance of many religious exemplars. Any one of us can live well. Universalism, the story of a loving God, no hell in that narrative, an inclusive universe. The challenge is to reach out then and embrace. It's not to exclude, to expand your circle of compassion, not to contract it, not to build walls around it. We refer to these stories as orienting, as helping us to navigate, find our way, guide our ship in this ocean of life and the universe. Gretchen Haley again says that each of us walks around with a number of stories we use consciously or subconsciously to help us understand the world and our place in it. They arrive out of our earliest years, our family systems, our accumulated life experiences. We hold shared stories, narratives about how things work and should be in our communities and in our families. Families definitely have stories. Congregations have stories. We have stories that help us know who we are, how we relate to each other, and what we mean to each other and why. These stories that we tell ourselves then organize what we pay attention to. They organize what concerns us, what we care about, and what we reject. Stories are one of the main factors in what psychologists call our perceptual set. As Unitarian spiritual director Andrea Anastos describes it, perceptual set is the way we select what we see or hear based on our preconceptions or expectations, and we interpret what we see or hear based on formative past experiences. How committed we are to a single story, how willing we are to open ourselves up to multiple stories, will determine just how possible reconciliation, liberation, and a deeper humility will be for all of us. The consequences of a deeply held perceptual set play out all the time at a global, societal, and also completely personal level. You might guess I would get to the election today, but that's what brings me to this election. Day after tomorrow. Day after tomorrow. Given the orientation of my perceptual set, mine, the narrative I tell, you can see how I might see the American story as inclusive, as I might frame it as multiple stories in conversation. It's because I want it to be that way. When I talked about looking out over the crowd at the Moral Monday gathering, I talked about seeing the America, the country, the way of being in the world that I wanted to see. There were people, young and old, of all colors, out in the crowd. Dr. Barber spoke to the fact that there were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people in the crowd, and that all of us together had a right to live fully before God. All of us were welcome in this gathering, in this country. That was the moral aspect of America, to focus on what was good for everyone. Look around in this congregation and think about the America that you are seeing. Just think, you can say, well, we're not very diverse, but you don't know because you haven't asked. Think about the backgrounds of the people in here who are German, Irish, Italian, Asian. I mean, you can just keep going as to who we are. And here we are, sitting in this place together, talking about many open stories. This is the story that I want to live well and live into reality. The narrative of this presidential election has been made predominantly about character, with very little focus on policies. And what is character? It's the story of a person, or the story we tell about the person. Listen how often you hear the word narrative used in the news. They're trying to change the narrative from the tapes to Bill, from the emails to Comey. They're trying to change the story being told rather than policy being discussed. Because of how I orient in the world, because of my vision of America, when I think about the presidential election, I personally take issue more with Donald Trump than I do with Hillary Clinton, because of how I have a perceptual set and then of the narrative I'm saying in my head. He promotes limited and limiting stories, and I can't support that. That's me. Misogynistic views of women, Muslims as terrorists, Mexicans as rapists, African Americans as predominantly poor and violent. Those are the storylines that he has consistently promoted throughout his campaign. Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale and the author of How Propaganda Works, in his recent article Beyond Lying, Donald Trump's Authoritarian Reality, points out that the goal of authoritarian propaganda is to sketch out a consistent system that is simple to grasp, a story that both constructs and simultaneously provides an explanation for grievances against various outgroups. It is openly intended to distort reality, partly as an expression of the leader's power to do just that. Ignore the details. This leader can make this happen. so that you, the in-group, will feel good. For example, Trump regularly says that America's inner cities are filled with Americans who are impoverished and of African-American descent. In a tweet on August 29th of this year, he wrote, "Inner city crime is reaching record levels. African-Americans will vote for Trump because they know I will stop the slaughter going on." It's a promo for a Netflix series on what is happening in Gotham. And what he said is not true. There is no national crime wave. Violent crime in the U.S. remains at historic lows, except for a couple of cities where it has risen a little bit. Trump is trying to define a simple, limiting story so voters will support the value system that he is promoting, focused on law and order. Law and order is a byline of an authoritarian value system, a story that limits stories to one story or few stories, and one or few storytellers, voices that get to be heard with authority or with credence. Dr. Stanley says that in this narrative, the chief authoritarian values are law and order. In Trump's value system that he is putting forward, non-whites and non-Christians are the chief threats to law and order. A limiting story to limit stories. And reality does not call for this response. Again, violent crime is at almost historic lows in the United States. He says that liberal democratic societies, by definition, have a pluralism of value systems in conversation with each other. That is their strength. That is our strength. Healthy liberal democracies embrace the stories and the change. He then goes on to say that this campaign has been an indictment of our understanding of mass communication. Either we lack the ability or concepts to describe authoritarian propaganda, or we lack the will. Either way, he says, we must do better. And then he says, how have we gotten to this place? Perhaps our media, as well as our academic class, assumes that we are a healthy liberal democracy and not susceptible to authoritarian rhetoric. He says, we now know this assumption is false. Describing what has happened requires us to talk. It's not just limited to the story of Trump. It requires us to talk not just about the importance of honesty and accuracy, but also about power, value systems, and in-groups versus out-groups. It also requires us to confront the failures of elite policy that have led to an erosion of democratic norms, primarily public trust, that makes anti-democratic alternatives suddenly acceptable. Exactly. That's one story, one narrative to look at and think about. I saw an interview with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, and she was asked, has this ever happened before in American history, or is this totally new? And she said, well, it really has. And she pointed to the presidential campaigns of William Jennings Bryan in 1896, 1900, and 1908. It was a time of expanding industrialization, of a change in the American landscape, of waves of immigration coming in. And she said that this was an analogous time. And then when you look at William Jennings Bryan, it turns out, what did he do? He also prosecuted the Scopes trial against evolution being taught in schools. So full circle. The other thing was, that was also the last time the Chicago Cubs won the World Series. And in our discussion of narrative on Friday night, we talked about that, and that came up independent of that discussion, but about How many families and fathers and sons and children got together around the Cubs playing in the World Series? And that, I read an article by the Dalai Lama last week who shares a very different narrative, very different story. He begins it by saying, in many ways, there has never been a better time to be alive. He shares a different story of all we have accomplished and where we live. And then he says, why the angst and fear and unhappiness in these successful developed countries? And he goes on to say that people don't feel needed. People don't feel needed. When you think about that, in our understanding, that's a question of faith, a question of meaning, life's meaning and feeling needed. He says, there are fewer among us who are poor, fewer are hungry, fewer children are dying, more men and women can read than ever before. In many countries, recognition of women's and minority rights is now the norm. There's still much work to do, and he lists that, but there is hope and there is progress. How strange, then, to see such anger and great discontent in some of, what, the world's richest nations. He goes on to say that research shows that people thrive when they feel needed. And then he says, what can we do to help? And the first answer is not systematic, it is personal. Back to individual with all that big picture. Everyone has something valuable to share. We should start each day... I'm not going to do that finger thing. We should start each day by consciously asking ourselves, what can I do today to appreciate the gifts that others offer me? Like the portraits hung in the quiet room. We need to make sure that global brotherhood and sisterhood and oneness with others are not just abstract ideas that we profess, but personal commitments that we mindfully put into practice every day. Each of us has the responsibility to make this a habit. There is a universal human hunger to be needed. Let us work together to build a society that feeds this hunger. I'd like to close with a piece by Gary Kowalski called Election Day. When he wrote it, it was the day before the election, but I'll just say it's 2 days before the election. As I write these lines, and whatever the outcome, I will be glad when it's over. Some will be elated by the results. Others will feel dejected. But regardless of who wins or loses, our world will still be broken and suffering from ills that government is powerless to cure. Our lives will still be chaotic and in need of tranquility. Grief and loss will continue to haunt us. We will still face the challenge of finding meaning and a faith that can sustain us through tough times. Campaigning in America often carries messianic overtones, and politicians collude in the drama by puffing their biographies to mythic proportions, an overarching story. They make big promises, but no new administration can deliver friendship. No new administration can deliver friendship, peace of mind, personal integrity, or a sense of self-worth. Finding the qualities that make life worth living, building them into our daily lives, and passing them along to our children will continue to be our personal responsibility, regardless of who controls town hall, Congress, or the White House. Voting is important, but there are many other ways in which we can exercise power in our own lives and influence the world for the better. Self-government, after all, begins at home. And how I treat my neighbor, relate to my family, care for my community and everyone in it, and how I work and play. Hope for the future depends less on who gets elected than on our ability to exercise our own power for the common good. The man and the woman said to God, we can't finish the world alone. You have the plans and we are too little. You are big enough, God answered them, but I agree to this. If you keep trying to finish the world, I will be your partner. On the days you think I am not doing enough, and on the days I think you are not doing enough, even on those days, we are still partners, and we must not stop trying to finish the world. That's the deal. Can we agree to that deal? Let's agree to that deal. Then the angels asked God, "Is the world finished yet?" God answered, "I don't know. Go ask my partners." Live these stories real.